Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Welcome to another exciting edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. From our Providence, Rhode Island studios, my conversation with legendary Rhode Island investigative reporter and media personality, Jim Hummel. Jim Hummel is a cornerstone of the Rhode Island media, working in print, television, radio, and for the last near decade, new media through his own Hummel Report investigations. Both a master journalist and entertaining performer, Hummel is uniquely positioned as the ultimate watchdog in Rhode Island politics.
All right, well, thank you, Mr. Hummel, the great Jim Hummel on the Bartholomew Town Podcast. Can't thank you enough for coming out this afternoon.
You better call me Jim or this interview is going to end quickly.
There it is, yeah.
You feel old.
We'll start again. Thanks again, Jim, for coming out.
Nice to be here, Mr. Bartholomew.
Yeah. A real pleasure to have you, and for those of our audience who's not familiar, which unless you've been living under a rock and you pay attention to Rhode Island, they definitely know who you are, but those who aren't, if you just give us a little summary of what you do with the Hummel Report and kind of your quick background here.
Yeah, we launched the Hummel Report 9 years ago. It's hard to believe. I was at ABC 6 Television for 13 years and had a pretty good run there, and we got some pretty bad owners. I mean, I know in this age of media now, it sounds a little naive to say they were morally bankrupt because local television has kind of gone that way, but it was pretty bad. So I left of my own volition 10 years ago, and I had spent 13 years with the Providence Journal before that. So all of a sudden, 26, 27 years goes by. But I left and was trying to figure out what I was going to do, and my timing was not good. I left in July of 2008, and of course, the economy totally blew up 2 months later. So Edward R. Murrow himself could probably not have gotten a job. But my wife, who has a pretty decent job at Rhode Island Hospital, I mean, we weren't going to survive on her salary forever. But she said, look, just take a little time and figure it out. And I wasn't worried about getting a job. I could have worked for a politician or for public relations, but I love reporting. So it took me about a year to figure out. So we launched the Hummel Report, and the thought was investigative journalism, long form, and couldn't have done it without the internet. So we're internet-based initially, and then we have media partners. We have radio, we have television, and now the Providence Journal most recently. So that's kind of the snapshot of where I am. And it's ironic because all those years when I was young, I was like, I want to go to a larger market. I almost went to the Los Angeles Times in 1990, and I placed second to this other guy. Well, now all of what I did kind of led up to what I'm doing now. And I'm very fortunate because most of the people I went to school with, and we all went to journalism school to change the world, they're out of the business now because the business has changed drastically.
Right. There's a lot of parallels with the music industry in that sense where labels either are non-existent or, you know, they're giving out very small salaries, if anything, you know, really, or fronting money for recording. So artists, musicians, you're kind of on your own in a way. And those that are, you know, that have the best package are the ones that break through. And you've, of course, broken through more than anyone else around here, that's for sure.
Well, I wish I could say I had some big, you know, vision and I'm Nostradamus. I just tried to stay one step ahead of the media wave. And when I joined the Journal in 1982, it was a pretty decent salary. Now, I was a single guy, no kids, and, you know, with the union, it was kind of five steps. So if you were topped out and you had four kids and you were a top scale, maybe not so good. But I made decent money and it was a union shop, when I was in first, you know, early reporter. And then when you get to television, you negotiate your own contract. So over the course of 13 years, I negotiated four or five contracts. And the goal every day, not that this is what you think about, but make yourself indispensable. And a lot of people want to be anchors. I filled in anchoring, but I love street reporting. And it was always to get people who know the area and can go out and turn a story. That became a valuable commodity. Now, you know, I run a nonprofit now. For 27 years, I went to work and picked up my paycheck at the end of the week and didn't really worry about the rest of the stuff. So now we're on a nonprofit model. I have to raise the money. I have to worry about the business end of it, the legal, all of that. But the trade-off is I have total editorial control over what I do. So I pick and choose every story. And maybe something that a network wouldn't go for, or maybe we want to spend a little bit more time doing something without the time constraints that I had in the daily journalism, I can do that now because I'm paying for it.
Right. And with your media partners, do you feel like you're almost able to push the agenda? For example, with your Providence Journal work, you're able to go into an area that the Projo probably wouldn't go into on their own volition, especially these days. Is that?
Yeah. Our goal, and it has been since we started, is to do what everybody is not doing. People will say, oh, 38 studios, or you want to look into the Paw Sox. There's enough media covering that. Our goal, and I think we've probably achieved it 95% of the time, and you got to figure, we've been doing this 9 years, that's like hundreds of stories, is to be leading the pack and fitting a niche of stuff that nobody else is doing. So my agreement with the Journal is I provide them two investigative stories and a nice one, which we'll talk about, the Rhode Island Spotlight, a month. And they pay me for it. And so they're pretty much accept, but they're not saying go out and do this or do that. They trust that I'm going to bring them a story that they want. And we're 6 months into this now. They have the right to refuse it, obviously, if they don't think it's a story that, but we haven't had that problem. And at the end of the day, they can make changes to my story, but I look forward to having a good editor like I did when I was with the Journal all those years ago, but I have to sign off at the end of everything that goes in. So every headline, every word, because I accept the liability. And so not only would I want to see it, I need to see it. Mm. And so the short answer to your question is yes, the Journal, I mean, it's hard for those of us who work there during the glory days, and it's not the Journal's fault, it's just the industry, to see when I worked there in 1982, we had 150 reporters covering in what we called the state staff alone. That was the bureaus. And I worked in every one of them. I was in Westerly, I was in Pawtucket, I was in West Warwick, all over covering Rhode Island. And now, I don't know what the numbers are, but they're down to 15, 20 reporters total.
Right.
And it's tough to watch. So it's been a nice marriage for us again. Alan Rosenberg, who's the executive editor, he and I have been friends for 35 years. We've watched each other's kids grow up, and we have lunch every 6 months together. So when he got appointed editor, shortly afterwards, we were having a lunch and we talked about a potential partnership. And I think it's really been a win-win. They get content and we get more eyeballs, which in my business is what you want, right?
Right. This podcast has a relationship like that with Newport Buzz. I don't know if you're familiar with,
oh, absolutely,
with the Buzz, yeah. In which we provide content, no editorial influence, or he's not suggesting guests or stories. We're just producing the content. And at first, I was hesitant for a second because I thought, well, we don't want to have on this podcast any, you know, sponsorship-based stories, you know, or anything, right, of that nature. But it does seem like it's a new way forward for releasing.
Well, you must
content
be doing a good job because they continue to pick you up, right?
Well, yeah, we've just started. We're a month. The podcast began 2 months. We launched about a month and a half ago, and it's a new thing. But, you know, the excitement is there, and the idea of producing content and having the full editorial control without submitting it to someone else to manipulate it is an appealing thing.
Well, this is, I love the podcast form too. It's like talk radio, and I do a lot of talk radio. It's, you know, in television, they're always yelling in your ear to wrap it up. You get a minute 20. And so the beauty of what I'm doing, when I was doing investigative reporting, I think the longest piece I ever did was 4 minutes and 48 seconds. And it seemed like a documentary back then for network television.
Right.
Now my pieces average 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes.
Yep.
So the subliminal or not so subliminal message that we're sending out, and people know our format, is we're going to sit down and we're going to have a reasoned discussion. And I think my greatest complaint in television, people would say, wow, I talked to that guy for 15 minutes and he gave me 13 seconds.
Right.
Now, at the end of the interview, most people are like, they're tired of looking at themselves because we give them so much time. And they know that. They know when they sit down to have an interview with me, and most people do. We only have to ambush people every now and then who don't want to talk to us. But when they sit down with me, they know at least I'm going to get my side of the story in. So the questions doesn't mean they're not going to be tough, but we'll be fair. I hate to say fair and balanced. Right. We'll fair and equal out the time for them.
Right. Right. That's something I definitely have noticed about your reports is there. And they move well between the opinions that may exist around surrounding an issue, and they leave the viewer in a very informed position to make a decision.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I tell everybody, it's East Providence this week, it's Johnston last week, it's Providence, it's wherever I'm going. I don't have any horse in any of these races. And I think most people know that. The problem now is people come in, and a lot of the blogs, and there's some, I think there are places for them, left-leaning and right-leaning, but you know there's going to be an opinion. I had the greatest compliment. Somebody who works on talk radio once told me, I have no idea what your political ideology is. And I said, well, that's the way it should be, because I have my opinions. I certainly, you know, when I'm in a lot different place. I'm 58 years old. When I was 22, I used to look at corruption kind of with an amused look. Oh, a guy took a kickback. Right. Well, now I own property. I had two kids go through public schools. My taxes are high, and it aggravates me. And so that's a lot of what drives me. And so when I go into a story, I mean, I try not to bring personal biases in, but we're all, you know, they always say, oh, you try to be objective. No reporter's objective. How you've been brought up, where you've been brought up, your age, your family is going to be a lot different than where I am. Somebody who's living just down the block from where we're taping this. And so it's that classic journalism class where you have 10 kids, you give them all a set of facts, and then you're going to have 10 different stories because everybody's going to come at it from a different angle. So again, I tell people, we'll give you as much time. If you sit down and talk to me, you get a bonus point for that because not everybody does. Doesn't mean the questions are going to be any easier. And at the end of the day, we hope to inform the public as to whatever issue we're diving into.
Right, and it was interesting on a lively lively experiment this past Friday. I noticed
one of my other hats. Well,
yeah, one of those. It's a great show. Brandon Bell mentioned, you know, when the Hummel Report does a story, when this is in regards to your East Providence work, the Board of Elections will hear it, hear that issue immediately, whereas he'll file appeal after appeal. And do you feel like you have a stature in this state where
I cashed his check right after?
Yeah,
he
I figured
wrote
as
that
much.
To
yeah,
me
okay.
As part
well
of
done.
Our PR
yeah.
budget. Well, so here's the deal. I've been here 36 years. So, with the exception of Kathy Gregg, I'm kind of the tenured guy here. Scott McKay's been around as long, but you know, in different venues. With my colleague at the Journal Now, Rhode Island Public Radio. So our mantra, and you see it at the top of our website at HummelReport.org, it says investigative reports that get results. And that's not just a catchy tagline. I have limited time. I have limited resources. I have limited, not space so much. When I go in and if I decide to go in on a story, it's because I think there's fire behind the smoke. And I think ultimately we're going to get a result out of it. Sometimes people resign. Sometimes people go to jail. Sometimes public policy is changed. Sometimes the Board of Elections gets involved because they're like, wow, this warrants our attention. So I'm pleased. I'm not surprised. I'm not disappointed if nothing happens. But usually people know when I make the phone call, I've already vetted out a lot of, you know, there's a lot of, we get dozens of tips every week. There's a lot of them that just don't make it for a variety of reasons. So if I'm really going to put the time and the effort into a story, I'm already probably 50% there on my opinion that it's something that needs to be addressed.
Right. Yeah, that comes to mind. The Charlestown, grew up in Charlestown, and the railroad line that they were going to install was going to go right through where I grew up, and it was a great story. Not necessarily over, you know, the issue's still there, but it, you know, when the story came out, I think a lot of people that weren't in Charlestown around the state were able to get the facts on what was happening there. And, you know, the visual aspect of
riding the train.
Right. And understand what the transformation that was going to take place if this new rail line was installed.
The beauty of what I'm doing now, and think about even 10, 15 years ago, when I was in television, this goes back to the dark ages. If you didn't see the 6 o'clock news, this was putting stuff on internet. I mean, people would tape it, and I taped all three stations just because that's who I am. It, who's going to do that, right? And so now the internet age is beautiful because on that Charlestown story, I had seen the Journal had done a short piece about I think there was a meeting at an elementary school locally in Charlestown, and I thought, you know, this story really would lend itself to visuals. Let's see where the farms are. Let's take a ride on the train. My brother lives in Old Saybrook, so I know that very well. And I do know, I mean, I don't go out and take credit that we turned it around. I think there were enough ears, particularly from the Connecticut delegation, because, you know, the whole old Lyme, Old Saybrook people were very upset with what was going on. But I do know that our link was passed to people, and it did make it to federal officials. And you got to wonder if at the end of the day, because we talked to the – in television, we always used to have a phrase, putting a face on a story. Quite literally, sometimes you have to put a face. Because otherwise, when I went from the Journal, my nickname was Print Boy, when I got over to television. Oh, look, yeah. Print Boy. Because not every story – there's some stories that are better suited to print than they are to video. And so one of the components I think about now is, will this be a compelling story visually with interviews? And look, I understand there's a little bit of entertainment involved. The ambush is fun to watch. This hit all of those buttons because there was drama. There was people who were, you know, giving voice to the voiceless. There was that visual of, look, this is where the train's going to go through. And what would it save? 1 minute, 2 minutes for what? $500 million of miserableness, right? Or angst. So when they said that they were going to back off on that, the Federal Rail or whoever it was, I was not surprised. What role we played in it, I don't know, because it got a lot of press coverage. But it was fun. It was a fun story to do. And you know, in journalism school, they teach you this basically, after all of the who, what, when, where, and why, you can comfort the afflicted and you can afflict the comfortable. And sometimes you get to do it in, you know, you get to do both of those things in one story.
That's pretty much the role of the artist, you know, the musician. I think it's very similar, you know. Absolutely. What I mean? That just, like, paint that picture and make it real.
Yes, you know, I mean? There's a lot of overlapping, what do they call them, a Venn diagram, right? There we are, all in intersecting circles.
Yeah, and that's where I find myself these days, is trying to sort that out, you know, what the role of we're an independent band, you know, we're not signed to a label or anything like that. So similarly, we have control of when we release something, how it's released.
But then you got to think about the marketing.
Then the marketing side of it's what you spent. You know, I've been at this for years, and yeah, we've made some strides, but you see those bands that have huge budgets, you know, within a few months go places that we haven't been able to because we don't have that marketing machine in place. So it's finding those partners, I guess, just like a media persona would do, you know, and building slowly but surely that credibility.
My original game plan, I left 10 years ago in July, and I had 9 months to think about it before we launched. Excuse me. I had a close friend who said, you do great work, but, you know, there's a billion websites out there. You've really got to have a built-in – you could launch your own website, which we did, but our partnership was with WPRO Radio. Yep. You know, classic AM talk – those are my people. All of the political junkies, leans a little conservative, but it doesn't really matter. When you're discussing a story is a story. And I'd had a great partnership with WPRO when I was at Channel 6. The promotion department was so pathetic that I was really a one-man promotional band when I was doing You Paid For It, which was kind of the model for what we're doing now. Government waste and corruption, of which we have a lot. So I had kind of carved this relationship with WPRO when we launched. It was all trade. There was no money involved. It was, they guarantee me the morning slot on Thursdays to debut it. And then there was never any mandate from the host to have to, oh, got to talk about Hummel's story. It was make your story compelling enough that people would want to talk about it. And so that's how that was kind of my goal every week. And some stories, we call them batting for the cycle. You do every single show.
Right.
Other stories, one host might like it and somebody else might not. But it was that media partnership. And WPRO really, although it reaches a different niche, there were a lot of people driving on the way to work who would say, hey, I heard you talking to the morning host, whoever that was, and that made me want to look at the website. Likewise, we started off with Motif Magazine.
Yep.
which was a great partnership. And my one, not regret, but the one thing I feel badly about is when we started with the Journal, the only thing they wanted exclusivity on was the print piece. So they said, you want to continue to partner with WPRO and Rhode Island PBS, which runs our spotlight pieces, that's fine. But it's confusing to be running, and plus we're paying you, right?
Right.
So we should have some level of exclusivity. So Motif was a great partnership because Jim Vickers, who owned it at the time, said to me, I've been looking to get hard news, because they do a great job on the theater reviews and the beer reviews, and, you know, it's an arts magazine, right? And the band reviews, but they didn't have hard investigative pieces. So that worked out really, really well for us. And then Rhode Island PBS. So again, I'm putting out the product, but you've got to be able to get eyeballs. And I knew that from Channel 6 because we always struggled in the ratings. And you'd go to it, this big effort to do a story, and then if people weren't watching, then at the end of the day, you kind of feel like, why am I doing this, right?
Yeah, I was a Channel 10 junkie, you know, growing up.
Most people were.
I wrote to Frank Coletta and Art Lake when I was in, like, elementary school. I have signed headshots, nice. The whole thing. You know, I was a maniac about it. And I always wondered. I wondered if it was, you know, the color scheme or why did 10 jump out, in at least during the 90s, and seem to jump so far ahead from a promotion side. When I would see your reports that you paid for reports, because I'd be watching whatever was Price is Right, and, you know, you'd catch interest even as a little kid.
Sure.
So I'd watch you, but then as a product, it just never had the same credibility as 10. Do you think that was just marketing?
No, well, I think part of it is, and we always wondered the same thing. We always joked they could run color bars for 27 minutes and still be number one. I think part of the issue was 10 was the first out of the blocks by 5 or 10 years. Over Channel 6 and to a lesser extent Channel 12. So people are very parochial. They were kind of first out of the block, and they've had great stability over the years. If you look at the anchor team, now Mark Searle's worked with me years ago, but I mean, Frank Capano and Patrice would have been there upwards of 35, 40 years each. Valicenti kind of worked his way up. He's been here since the early 90s, so in the market 25 years. Whereas the other stations, there, especially with 6, there was a lot of turnover. So I think part of it's the stability. Part of it, I think, it's the first in the block. Because it's a dichotomy between here and the rest of the country. The rest of the country, ABC leads. It's pretty, you know, back during the 90s, it was always must-see TV with 10, so they had a big lead in, but ABC was very, very strong, and we were the anomaly. The network could do great, but the local stations were not doing as well. So, you know, I thought about that. I also, the funny part was, you would show up to a scene and everybody knew who the Channel 10 reporter was. And by the end of my career, I wasn't worried about that. But you had to work harder. And in effect, you had to talk people more into interviews. And it really laid the groundwork for when you were out there and it was just you and people. When people knew me, they'd say, oh, yeah, and they'd invite me into their living room. That happened every day with Channel 10 reporters. Channel 6 and 12, to a lesser extent, had to hustle a little bit more. And that kind of – it kind of prepared me for what I'm doing now. I set up all of my stories. You know, at 10, I don't know how it is now, but in the old days, the assignment desk would kind of set it up and say, here, show up here, and here's the story. We had to lay the groundwork for all of our stories, and I'm used to doing that. And so that's kind of prepared me now, because we work on a pretty lean staff, and part of it is my personality. I want to make sure I'm talking to the person, having a little pregame show before we get there. What can you expect? You know, what do you know of me? So when we arrive for the interview, there's really no surprises.
Right. Well, that's really interesting background on, you know, from your perspective there. You know what I mean? And yeah, and the weatherman shift, kind of a shakeup. I remember when Lay all of a sudden, just Gary Lay disappeared and Mark Searles came in. Was that simultaneous?
Yeah, well, I think they were looking for a younger look. And part of it was the ownership at the time. They may have been trying to cut back because I know Kelly McGee left. She had been there for a while. Mark was with us really early on when he looked about 16. And I should talk. My nickname was Opie when I first started at the Journal. First meeting I covered at the Journal, I was in North Providence, and I was all dressed up, but I really looked like I was in junior high, which I came to appreciate later, younger looks, because, you know, when you're young, you want to look old, and then when you're old, you want to look young. And I went up to this guy on the North Providence Town Council, and I introduced myself. Hi, I'm Jim Hummel with the Providence Journal. He goes, you're with the Journal. My paper keeps landing in the bushes. Can you get it back up on the porch? Dude, I don't deliver your paper. Yeah. I'm the reporter because you look kind of young, which was good because I didn't start in television until I was 35. And that was considered pretty old. Seems pretty young now, but it was pretty old at the time, and I had 13 years of experience. So most people come right out of college and do it. They hired me because I was a reporter. They weren't hired because I was a polished TV guy.
There's a big difference.
That was kind of an add-on.
It seems like there's a huge difference between someone who's almost like an actor, you know, spokesperson character versus a reporter who just happens to know how to perform.
Well, we used to laugh that the TV guys were a bunch of blow dried fluff boys, you know, a lot of not too much upstairs, and then I became one. I had concerns actually, and a guy who really helped me through it was the late Jack White, Tim White's father.
Sure, yep.
Pulitzer Prize winner with the Providence Journal, and actually his career kind of mirrored mine. He spent 13 years at the Journal and then went to television 10 years ahead of where I was. Mm-hmm. So I talked to Jack because I had concerns about, you know, will I have enough time to tell the story? Is it really kind of plastic? And this was back in the mid-90s when television, I wouldn't say it was new, but going from when I left the Journal, now you got to realize the Journal, this was pre-internet and they were still family-owned and they were probably making a 35% profit back then. And that company got sold for $1 billion.
That was the Belo Corporation.
Belo. They wanted the TV stations, though. They didn't want the Journal as much. Because even back then, it was beginning to fade a little bit.
Yep.
When I left the Journal, everybody said, Hummel, why are you – and television, man, you got to negotiate your contract, and they could bounce you after 3 years. And, you know, it was a union shop. So unless you were doing something tremendously wrong, there were little chance back then that they would get rid of you. Then the layoffs happened because of the economy. But when I left, people were like, Hummel, you could retire at the Journal. And I said, you know why I'm leaving? Because I could retire at the Journal. I said, I've pretty much done what I want to do, and I'm ready for the next challenge. And there are some people, I don't begrudge them at all, but there's some people who are still there that when I left. And it's funny now because I'm working with editors. The guy who I'm working with, Kurt Mayer, who's the Sunday editor on my investigative pieces, he was there 23 years ago when I left. He's a great editor. But you realize there's that kind of small core of people still there committed to good journalism and trying to do it every day.
Do you think the Projo has and newspapers in general, all the way up to the New York Times, what's the future look like and for print? Is it going to be exclusively digital at some point here?
Well, you know, they've tried that. They tried that years ago. The Rocky Mountain News, which was kind of the corollary to the Denver Post, they tried to go online totally, and it didn't work. And the problem is monetizing it because people still, although the Journal slipped in circulation, advertisers, at least for now, still look at the broadsheet as opposed to digital. We always used to call it pennies on the dollar as opposed to digital as the broadsheet. If they could monetize it and make it work digitally, they would, because you would save on chopping the trees down and the delivery and all of that. Yep. The analogy is almost like the Evening Bulletin was still around when I joined. And actually, when I started with the Journal, the afternoon paper, the Bulletin, had twice the circulation as the Journal. Think of that, 150,000 to 75. Because Rhode Island's a working class state. So people would go to their factory jobs in the morning, and they'd get home and they'd read the paper. And so that old change in the Journal, the Bulletin was extinct. I think they've got to figure out a way. I think it depends on the market. The New York Times, I think, is doing very well. The Washington Post has been able to figure it out. The Boston Globe, to a lesser extent. The Journal, I think, is still trying to figure out how you get people to buy into the paywall. And the New York Times was very smart. After Donald Trump was elected, they approached, and most papers did this. Look, the truth matters. Facts matter. A direct kind of contrary to what we're hearing out of the White House, and they offered me a $7.50 a month online subscription.
Right.
They hooked me, and I was like, how could I not?
Right. Back to student pricing, basically.
Right, but you know what? It's not costing them anymore because it's digital. Right. They're not delivering the paper, so it's all cream off the top for them.
Yep.
So I think they raised it to $11 on my first year anniversary. I was expecting it to double, but it's still a smart move. Now, they've got a national platform. The Journal, where are they going to be 5 or 10 years from now? I don't know. I mean, I think Alan Rosenberg is working very hard, the executive editor, who has been there almost 40 years now, came right out of Northwestern. He's from Chicago to work here. He started when he was 20 or 21. He's looking to go out of the box like with me. I mean, bringing me in, name recognition, paying me enough, obviously, to I think justify our product for them, but it's not the cost of having to hire a reporter, right? And so he's using some other freelancers, which I know kind of aggravates the union, but I think at the end of the day, the union's got to realize that, is there going to be a product there to be able to, you know, we're all in this together. We're trying to preserve everybody's job, not me, we, but if they're at the paper, you've got to make your paper viable in order for your paycheck to exist every week. I'm beginning to sound like a conservative non-union guy, and it's not that way. It's not that way at all, but because I was a member of the Providence Newspaper Guild for 13 years, but having run a business now, I get it. I get it that you got to have the income. You got to, you know, do all of that to make yourself viable. Cause then at the end of the day, if you don't have those tools, you won't have a job.
All right. It's about what consumers want, too. Consumers love the Vice videos, and they love videos like what you do, you know, and they love podcasts and Instagram stories and things like that. You know, maybe that's something that traditional print media will kind of shift towards expanding their releases.
Absolutely. You know? And I tell classes that I speak to, the biggest change in journalism, I mean, it seems so obvious, but for somebody my age, when you got the journal or you watched the local news, it was somebody deciding what you were going to watch or view. You pick up the paper, and we had a 9 o'clock in the morning meeting every day. Okay, we've got this, and this. What, and at the news station too. What are we going to have for the 6 o'clock news? We're going to have for the paper. They would meet again at four to finalize the thing. That was their decision. Now it's all on your phone. It's on your iPad. You decide what, when, and how much you're going to watch and read. And to, you know, to people, my kids, I have twins who are 20. That seems so obvious now, but think about that. Before the internet came, you had none of that control. Whatever channel 6, 10, and 12 decided, that's what you were going to see. And you didn't have access to the wire machines or anything else. The journal was deciding that we're going to be the arbiter of what is news. And consumers are now saying, no, I'm going to get it in a podcast. I'm going to get it here and there. The funny part, when I first met with Alan Rosenberg, he wasn't quite sure. He knew he wanted my content. And I said to him, what about the video? He was not even thinking. I mean, I live in the world of video, right? And this is no knock on Alan, but he was kind of like, the video. We can take that too.
Why that wouldn't come up in a sense as the first thing is interesting, you know what I mean? Because that's how, even when you announced that partnership, I remember thinking, all right, here we go, Projo. Maybe there's going to be an app that, you know, when the new Hummel report's posted, and boom, there it is. You know,
right. And then, so are. Look, I understand it takes people. Look, most people's attention span is for the, you know, what is it, the Commerce Corporation with the fun-sized, right? It's right. Whatever, 15 seconds. Mine is not fun-sized. But, so, and I'm not trying to reach everybody with every video. I mean, obviously my piece went viral in East Providence when that happened. Same with Johnston a month ago, same in Charlestown. So a good story is a good story, but it's also localized that if you're hitting your audience in that place, they will watch all 10 minutes. Now, I try not to abuse it. I mean, a lot of times I'm thinking, could I trim this by 2 minutes? And I thought, what the heck? If people are going to view – people in East Providence where there's really no local reporting, the journal doesn't have any presence there, and with all due respect to the East Providence Post or the reporter or whatever it is there, they're not going to take on a big investigative piece. So if I'm putting in all the time to gather this information, why wouldn't I give it to them? In the early days of the Hummel Report, and I don't do this as much, we would put up what I call the director's cut. So I did profiles on all the governor's races. I did it in 2010, 2014. Hope to do it again. I'll have to talk to the journal about it. I interviewed Patrick Lynch when I was doing stories years ago about the stories that led to the mayor of Central Falls being put in prison. We put up an extra – I did a 5 or 6 minute piece, and then I'd put up an extra 7 or 8 minutes from our interview just to listen to us talk. So not everybody's going to watch that. But if you're living in the community where it directly affects you, or maybe you're interested to see what Bob Healy has to say, or maybe you haven't really heard John Robitaille, or you have, you know, you've kind of heard about Link Chafee, but let's sit down and listen to the questions that I ask him. So that's been kind of fun for us because we have the ability to be able to do that. I still think the vast majority of people, when your story is stripped across the top of the Sunday Journal, for all the people who are saying, oh, nobody reads the journal anymore, it's astounding how many people still read the journal. Because it's not just print. They have a big promotional machine. And a shout out to their digital people. I mean, they They're very good on social media. I'm also embedding podcast sound for the Macaulay House piece. I used 5 different interviews and put up probably a minute or two of extra sound with each person in a headshot. And that's what people more of your generation and age are looking for. All right, quick little boom, 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 boom. I can listen here or I can move on. So the journal is adapting, not through the old guy, but through the younger people kind of pushing the old guy to do that. So when I do a piece now, the elements, it's probably the same reporting, but I do an 8, 9, 10 minute video piece. I do probably a 15 to 1800 word print piece. We do a video promo that runs the day before, the 2 days before we launch. That usually runs a minute. So got to edit and close caption that, do all the podcast sound, and then we do social media. So there are a lot more elements to it than it was before. We're simply putting out the video takes long enough to edit, but all of those elements are trying to reach a little bit of a different audience, I think.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, but it's well worth it because you're able to pull people back to the original idea.
And it goes back to that guy who said, boy, he interviewed me for 15 minutes and I got 13 seconds. Now we're pretty much, it's like the peasant farmer who gets absolutely everything out of that last potato that he has, right?
Totally.
Yeah, it's like there is no waste when they kill the cow, they use absolutely everything.
Right.
We're squeezing everything we can out of it. And that's kind of gratifying at the end of the day because you feel like all of your effort is going in a variety of outlets and directions.
Let's just talk about talk radio for a second. One of my favorite formats. Love hearing you on WPRO. And what is it about talk radio that allows for such an intimate connection between the host and audience?
Well, I think Rhode Island's always had a very strong talk radio. You go to other parts of the country, they have sports talk radio, but the whole politics, and honestly, that's because everybody in Rhode Island's a nosebag, right? They want to know what's going on in the back, and they want to know everything. They want to know about the guy who's getting indicted. They want to know about stuff at the state house. They want to know about the guy who's growing the 6-foot cucumber next door, and, wow, where did that come from? Yeah. Is he using drugs to, enhance it? Whatever. And so there's been this, my mother, both my parents have died, but when my mother died actually 10 years ago, about 5 months after I left the station,
yeah.
She was a 1947 graduate from Wellesley, and she majored in Greek. So that's all you need to know about my mother. And she would go, I don't get talk radio. Don't these people have jobs? I was totally. Like, she also didn't get the bread and milk thing. She was like, dude, what do they want to make, French toast? So
yeah, I don't
my
get
mother
that
was kind of, right. So my mother, but you know what? A little bit of validity to that. Who are all these people who call? Well, what I found is you get a little bit of the whack jobs, but there are also some people who are really paying attention and you get your regular callers, obviously, but there are people who are paying attention. And I always say when I run into people, I say, hey, I heard you on the radio. So why don't you call in? Oh, I would never call in.
Yeah.
So, the vast majority of people only do listen. But there's a back and forth. And I will tell you now, the journal listens to talk radio more than they would like to let on. Because I'll see often, Kathy Gregg will say, well, so-and-so had an interview. Link Chafee announced for Senate.
On Tara Granahan.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they're breaking news. And I think you got to take talk radio for what it's worth. There's a lot of stuff sometimes that comes out unvetted, but I also think there are newsmakers. I think when they had that whole boycott with DePietro, I think it really hurt. For some candidates, it gave them immediate cover. The Democrats, for those who don't know, the Democratic Party, kind of the union, kind of led by the union people, were going to boycott WPRO because of some comments that DePietro said. By the end of the boycott, nobody could remember what it was. So I think it gave some people cover, but I also think it hurt some candidates who could have come on. And again, to have an hour on the air and to talk back and forth and take, I think most people give you bonus points for taking calls from callers and sitting down and answering to the best of your ability. And honestly, if you're worried about talk radio, you probably shouldn't be in the game because you're going to be facing harder questions in a debate, aren't you? Right?
Yeah, you would.
It's kind of a good warm-up, I think, for a campaign.
Yeah, and it's been the way that some candidates for governor it's been really the only way some have actually reached people, And like Joe Trillo, for example, that's pretty much been his MO over the last few
years.
Yeah,
and Governor Raimondo to a lesser extent. I mean, this whole doing it through spokespeople, and I've always thought, and I know Gina Raimondo, I don't know her well, but I've seen her in enough settings. She's got a great laugh. She's very personable, and that's not the person you see through the eyes of certain media. And I'm not picking on media. I'm just saying her handlers have her all bottled up. And I always said, because I covered a good part of Buddy Cianci, as we called it, Buddy 1 and 2, and I covered the trial and all of that, Cianci would wear you out. I mean, he would be like, all right, any question you want, and then at the end, we'd all look at each other like, you got anything else? I got nothing. And he'd take as long as it needed. Raimondo would be smart, and I'm sure she has other people telling her, don't do this, because she's been exposed a little bit on UHIP and some other things. Every week or every other week, schedule a time. All right, 10 o'clock on a Monday morning, 10 o'clock on a Tuesday morning. We're going to have a wide-open press conference in the stateroom. Anybody can come. Well, in the media. You don't want to have – and honestly, and people say, why can't the people come? Well, no, this is a press conference. And so you show up, and you can ask me any question you want for as long as you want. What could be more important every 2 weeks? Visiting the Burrillville Senior Center, it's because they want to lower the exposure. And they did this when Sheldon Whitehouse ran. I ran, being Rhode Island, I ran into Sheldon, and I'd known him when he ran for Attorney General, his first race back in 98. So we've known each other. He was in my brother's class at Yale. His father was in my father's class at Yale. I mean, think of that, 44 and 78. Yeah. We're not friendly, but we certainly know each other. I ran into him at Sports Authority in Seekonk, and I said, hey, he said, Jim, hey, what are you doing here? And we talk about our kids. His kids were a little bit older, and I said, hey, I was doing Six News on the Record, which is a Sunday show. I said, hey, want to get you on Six News on the Record? He said, yeah, anytime, I'll come. So I called his people, and the woman who was running the campaign, this is like February, she said, how about the last week in May? I burst out laughing. I said, what do you mean the last week in May? What could be more? I said, how much do you spend on a half an hour of television? And she said, oh, I don't know the answer to that question. I said, you're getting a free half hour of television with questions, but it's exposure. You know who was in the seat the next week? Steve Laffey.
There it is, yeah.
Right? He was like, I'll clear my schedule. Let me know when to come. So Sheldon Whitehouse's people, they had these people out of Chicago who are like, the media is the enemy. And in Chicago it was. They didn't get that in Rhode Island, it's retail politics. We expect to run into our politicians and to have conversations with them in the supermarket. Same with Gina Raimondo. And I think it's a big disservice to her, because I think communications people or consultants, whoever, ultimately I fault her, because, you know, they answer to her.
They can fire David Ortiz or, you know, whatever it is.
Or Mike Rea or whoever else. And I, you know, and then you get into this whole social media thing. Rea is a guy he's like, he should be wearing a skirt and pom-poms. Right. I've said this before. I mean, he's not a communications guy. He's all cheerleader. And then he starts getting into pissing matches with reporters on Twitter. And then he has a personal Twitter account. And so, look, everything that I put out on Twitter, I always felt this when I was at Channel 6 or with the Journal. I don't really have a personal life. I can put something out personally, but if I don't expect backsplash from my professional capacity, and if you don't like that, then don't take on the job.
Yeah, don't go into the public realm, whatever, in any capacity, if you don't want to hear about it.
You know, I don't – I've taken it probably a little bit to an extreme. I don't drink in public. Whenever I'm at a public event, I just don't drink, because – something's going to, oh, I saw Hummel pounding down a couple of beers, or if God forbid I got in an accident, oh, you know, he had a gin and tonic in his hand. And it's to me, it's not worth the ag. I'll always have a glass. It doesn't mean I don't drink. I'll go out with some friends and have a beer and whatever. But if I'm in a public setting, it's always a glass of water, because I think when you have a public persona, there are things that are expected of you. And I'm not just picking on Mike Rea, but there are a lot of spokespeople out there now who kind of want to have it both ways. And I think part of that is they're younger and a little bit less mature. And I just – but again, the governor's hired these people, right? And if she saw something wrong, you know, it's easy to kind of put it off on them to create the shield. So I don't know. We got kind of off on a tangent there. But I see it now in this whole Twitter – there's this, you know, there's this back and forth that goes between reporters that I think is a little too comfortable. And I saw David Cicilline interacting with a reporter once, and it's like, dude, you cover that guy. You shouldn't be talking about personal things in a public venue. Now, that's a 58-year-old guy talking rather than maybe a 35-year-old reporter. But I think there really does need to be some old-school standards applied to today, because I think it gets you into trouble. Look at how many people have gotten – I mean, we don't want to talk about the tweeter-in-chief, but, I mean, right on down the line, you think of how Twitter has gotten people in trouble. When I went from the Journal – to television, my biggest revelation was all of those three and four sets of eyes that saw my stories before they went into the paper. My first live shot ever in television, 30 seconds before they came to me, a bug flew up my nose. And I was like, Jet! And I'm like whacking. And so the director's thinking, Print Boy's having a seizure. Yeah. Or he's been doing a little nose candy that we don't know about. And I managed somehow to extract the bug, and then I pulled off the, thank you, Larry, that was a great question. But it made me realize there's no filter on live TV. Yeah. And it's the same thing that you have so many reporters trying to tweet from, and I realize this is the game now, they're trying to tweet and Instagram and all of the other things involved, that let's concentrate on the story, right? They demand a lot of reporters. I mean, I would never recommend, my daughter's in the journalism school at North Carolina. She has no interest in being a reporter. She wants to do marketing. She wants to do public policy. And I'm like, everybody's like, are you disappointed they're not going into journalism? I'm like, I'm kind of relieved to tell you the truth. I mean, yeah. Isn't that sad?
It's extremely sad. It's sad that, like, not just journalism, but so many artistic-oriented and, you know, public service-oriented careers are either disappearing, if they ever were there in some ways, but are disappearing or changing to the point where, you know, you literally have to be a Lyft driver and, you know, have another job in order to make that art or make that journalistic ambition happen. You know?
Yeah, and it's, you know, the internet is helping us. The internet is killing us. I mean, right. What I'm doing now, I mean, think about it. At the journalism school at the University of North Carolina, first of all, the you know, the TV people were considered entertainers, and that was not serious journalism. So I started out in print, expected fully to be in print, went over to television, and if you look at where it is now, I'm only able to do what I'm doing because of the internet. At the same time, it's helping kill off newspapers. It's killing retail. It's killing, I mean, it's just as easy to go on Amazon as to go down to Kohl's, right? Or to go to
easier.
Wherever. Yeah. You know, and it can, if you have Amazon Prime, you can do it, get it in 2 days. So, I don't know. It's the technology is kind of, it's a double-edged sword. And fortunately, I've been able to react to it. I mean, I love what I'm doing. Some people say, oh, they've been after me to do talk radio for years. I think the problem is if you're in that job full time, you eventually have to cross a line that I'm not willing to cross and maintain maintain what I'm doing. Now, someday, who knows when, maybe I'll get tired of chasing around. I love what I'm doing now, but who knows, 5-10 years from now, then I'll sit in a studio and bloviate and have, you know, Chris the Furniture Man and Spence from Smithfield and Pat from Cumberland.
Mary from Foster.
Mary from Foster, one of my favorite friends. And actually, I have people who call up who I know now. I know their voices that I know. It's like Frank from Smithfield. That's really Joe from Cranston, you know?
Gotcha.
Like anybody's – like there's like talk radio police who are going to come, I know you're really Joe from Cranston.
Right. Well, I continue to call as William from Newport anytime I – you know, even though I'm up here in Providence, keep that persona alive, you know?
There you go. Although you get to know people's voices, right?
Right. Absolutely.
It is funny with my voice because the whole – I've always had kind of the booming voice, and I was – we have a local alumni club for the University of North Carolina, and we meet at a local bar, and I had a woman – we had to watch the games, and I had a woman come over and go, are you Jim Hummel? <I'm> like, yeah. And she, you know, usually – sometimes because I was on television a while, I said – Did you recognize me? She goes, oh, that voice. I can hear that voice. It's very distinctive. And I'm like, oh, boy. And my wife was like, yeah, I know that voice.
Yeah.
Been listening to it for 25 years. It's crazy.
If you don't mind, just real quick, let's shift to the gubernatorial race here.
Sure.
Had Giovanni Ferrosi in that throne a few days ago.
How was that?
It was interesting.
He's never lacking for words, huh?
No, I would say that we had a 75-minute taping. I probably spoke for no more than 60 seconds total.
Nice. You just wind him up and let him go.
That's it. He had some interesting points on drones and tiny houses.
What's the blockchain? What is that? You know what that is?
Yeah, it's basically a technology that the Reader's Digest version, as I understand it, so it creates cryptocurrency. It's a way to govern the creation of money or the creation of anything, a contract, by basically artificial intelligence and computer systems. And he wants
then
to make...
he's running in the wrong state.
You would think so.
Because you got... Do you think the guy six blocks over from here understands any of that?
Well, that's what I tried to get out of him was, you know, he's... claims to be the best leader, you know, that there can be. And he does have a resume.
Oh, he's got
that's,
the military
that's
background.
Absolutely.
And I don't think he's had mixed business success.
Quite mixed, right.
And he's fully ready to answer all of that. So pose a question. We got to
go on.
Let's talk about the governor's race. And I'm like, what do you want to know?
Where does it stand here? I spoke with Joe Trillo in his studio. Matt Brown's coming in here.
You go to his studio into the dungeon?
It was something else. It was.
Did he make you give him your cell phone?
He did not because I recorded it on there. But
he does that occasionally.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That was an interesting experience. Once I started to press him on, you know, the comments that he made about, you know, supporting
Starbucks and
everything. You know, how much longer are we going to be doing this for? You know, but
yeah.
But it's interesting to look at this picture now with Matt Brown in on the left. Is anybody going to really challenge Gina Raimondo?
Well, we'll see. Matt Brown kind of left under a little bit of a cloud, and I don't know where his money's going to come from. And the progressive, they're making inroads at the state house, but at the end of the day, Scott McKay talked about this on Lively Experiment. They're going to make it very miserable for him because they're going to lock up all the best consultants and the fundraisers, and where is his support going to come from? And so all of that, I just, you know, it's not for this election, but I think I've seen enough of these elections now. Buddy Cianci won with 34% of the vote back in the beginning of Buddy 2 back in 1990. You saw Link Chafee do it, and you saw Gina Raimondo do it. To win with less than 50%. And I just don't think that's right. I think we need to come up with a system. It would be a constitutional amendment to have a runoff election. Because if you think about it, if Matt Brown had run as an independent, you'd have Raimondo, you'd have Trillo, you'd have Matt Brown, and then you'd have whoever the Republican's going to be. You could conceivably win with 30% of the vote, right?
Right.
It's just it's a bad system, I think. And so does that help or hurt? I think what will happen is, and I've been giving this a lot of thought, I think if he raises enough money and mounts enough of a credible – problem is the primary's in September. Nobody's really paying attention. You know, you're at the beach, and all of a sudden Labor Day's here, and then all of a sudden it's the election. What he will do is, if you remember, when she ran 4 years ago, it was Angel Tavares and it was Clay Pell, and she spent a lot of money and had to lock and load. I think that's why she's raising so much money. No money's enough.
Yeah,
she raised almost $4 million, and people are like, why would you do that? Well, now you didn't expect this primary challenger, right? And so she can kind of flood the airwaves as Sheldon Whitehouse did back in 2006. You kind of buy – I'm not saying you buy the election, but, boy, you see a lot of those ads that make your candidate look really, really good. You're not going to hear the words UHIP at all.
That's
in any
sure.
of those ads. You're going to see a crane in the sky. You're going to see the – that's why she has her little videographer running around taking pictures of the press conferences of Johnson & Johnson and all of that. So I still think it's her race to lose. A lot of it will depend on how – I do think Alan Fung is going to come out of the Republican primary. I think Patricia Morgan's I just don't think she has enough name recognition. I mean, we all know her. I also think there's some times she doesn't do her homework altogether.
For sure. I mean, some Dan York interviews, even in things she's put out, have been questionable on Twitter in the last few days. So that's concerning. You know, just
and Alan Fung now has he has his own Cranston record. And I also think that whole ticket scandal, I really thought he was bloodied by that. I thought, well, you know, that's 4 years ago. You have to kind of remind people of what that is. Now Gina Raimondo has a record, and she would say, I'm going to run on my record, when Alan Fung would be like, great, let's run on your record, and let's look at the roadworks and Cooler and Warmer and the UHIP and all of that. And so I think we'll hear from her about some of the accomplishments. I do think you only get, you know, so many chances in your political capital. I remember Don Kachiri had great political capital that he built up after the Station nightclub fire. He was always very approachable.
He came back from Florida.
Arrived, and he was just great that week. But then and I was at the smoke shop raid down in your hometown.
Yep, so was I, actually.
Were you there?
Yeah, my friend's growing up father was the chief of police of Charlestown. He gave us
Tom Sharkey.
Yeah,
almost arrested me.
Is that right?
Okay. I kind of pushed him out of the way because I didn't know who he was. Yep. I knew all the state police, and he's like, he put his hand in front of the camera, and I was like, dude, it's like me grabbing your gun, and we made peace afterwards. But you see me like coming across and like body blocking this guy to get out of the way, and he's like, hey, that's assault on a police officer. Yep. The bottom line was, I think Kachiri realized he could have handled that a little bit differently, but he had a lot of political capital. I think the governor started out with no political capital, and then at the end of her first session, when nobody would have said, boy, Jeannie, it really didn't get a lot done, she tried to launch roadworks without doing the homework.
Right.
Right? And that was the first bad first impression. And then it was followed by cooler and warmer. And then it was followed by UHIP, which nobody ever expected to be, have gone on. I mean, what's it been,
this
a year
is insanity,
and a half? It's going on 2 years. So,
it's absolutely
and you
insane.
Know, it's and it kind of reinforces that you got a millionaire governor who ran whether that's valid or not, ran a capital venture firm, and now she doesn't care that this guy can't get his insulin. So.
Yeah, it's bad optics and really bad facts. The question is, does anyone have what it would take to overtake her at this point?
Well, and it's a Democratic state, isn't it? So I think Matt Brown was thinking he probably has better chance of picking her off in a – I don't think he's going to do it. Well, I shouldn't say that. People always say, oh, it's going to happen in November. Well, talk to me, a month before the election. Arlene Violet lost her race for re-election because one of her prosecutors lost, whether it was his fault or not or whatever – it was the public optics that one of her – a major case that her office had been prosecuting, the verdict came out like 3 or 5 days before the election. And it just kind of reinforced some of the opposition that some people had had. Arlene came in and kind of shook things up, and that kind of upset the apple cart for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But – so let's see where we are around Labor Day for the primary, and let's see where we are in mid-October for the other election. A lot of stuff could happen, right?
Totally. Do you think Lieutenant Governor Dan McKee might throw his hat in the ring for governor with Aaron Regenberg's challenge?
I don't think so, and I don't know. Regenberg, he's never had a job, and you're going to hear that from McKee. And, public service is great, and I don't know where his money's coming from. He just released his taxes. He makes $16,000 a year. I'm not sure where his wife is. I mean – so people are going to ask questions about that. Do you have independent wealth? And there's nothing wrong with public service. I mean, Sheldon White, I think years ago I always thought Claiborne Pell and John Chafee and Bruce Sundland, these guys were – I think they did well because everybody in Rhode Island thinks that a politician's in it because his hand's in somebody else's pocket. Yeah. Those guys were independently wealthy.
They played that very well.
Right. Absolutely. And, why would I need to take a kickback because I don't need that, right?
Right.
So Regenberg's a bit of a curiosity to me. I think he's going – I already see, the teachers' unions. McKee's been pretty strong on charter schools, and they don't like that. I saw Representative Greg Amore really blasted McKee. McKee doesn't toot his own horn a lot. He does some of these behind-the-scenes things with the PUC and National Grid, and, of course, he had a long record as mayor of Cumberland. So I don't know how that race is going to play out. The other thing is, where's the coverage going to come from? It all comes full circle back to the media, right? People are going to be so – where's the journal's horses right now, right? So who's going to cover when you got Link Chafee running against Sheldon Whitehouse and you got Matt Brown running against Gina Raimondo? Who's going to be paying attention to Regenberg and McKee?
It's going to slip through the cracks.
Yeah, short of alternate media, but I mean on a statewide level.
Right.
And those debates, if you do them on 10 News Conference or wherever, they're going to be in the middle of August.
Right. People, I'll be at the beach.
Right.
I might catch up on
back
it later.
Back to Charlestown.
Yeah. Anyone in – last question. Anyone in Rhode Island or otherwise that you kind of looked up to in the media or even as a political leader, someone that's – kind of been your inspiration?
That's a great question. I really did look up to Jack White and how he and Jack was not a sexy television guy. He just kind of told
a big guy.
Told the story.
Yep.
But you knew he always did his homework and you knew it was solid. I always loved Charles Kuralt, not just because he went to the University of North Carolina, but he was a guy, he would never make it on TV now. I mean, he's a guy who was kind of dumpy, and again, he broke in 30, 40 years ago. story on Kuralt was I was the editor of the Daily Tar Heel, which is the student newspaper at the University of North Carolina, in 1982. He had been the editor in 1954 during the height of desegregation, and he actually wrote letters under other names pro-desegregation in an effort to stimulate the kind of get the conversation going, and it did. Both on the North, I mean, so some people would call that fake news now.
Or buying likes on Facebook or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that.
But there was a time and a place back then. I mean, everything right. else was rock solid. And I always admired that because at a time when it would have been easy not to do that. And then, of course, he went on to a whole nother career with the On the Road and telling the stories and kind of giving the voice to the voiceless. Some were feature stories, but some had a real edge to it. So I always really, I admired Kuralt. There were a lot of print guys that I really liked when I was earlier in my career. David Broder, I always thought, was a wonderful columnist. I liked David Brooks, the New York Times. And Frank Bruni, actually, was 3 or 4 years behind me at North Carolina. I just saw him, the Daily Tar Heel, at 125th anniversary. It's amazing how long the paper, 1893. And Bruni came back. I know a lot of the people kind of right before me and right after me. And so they've gone, and Emily Steele, who broke, she just won a Pulitzer. She had worked at the Tar Heel probably 10 or 15 years after I did. She broke the Bill O'Reilly story with a team of people. So there's that legacy. I was very fortunate early in my career. The Daily Tar Heel was a place, and that's I started the first day of my freshman year, and I had editors who really worked with me every day to make sure it was a writer's newspaper. And then the Journal was. Alan Rosenberg wrote a column over the weekend about Don Murray. I was there. He was a writing coach. They would bring him down from New Hampshire. And they did a story. They had a great contest called How I Wrote the Story. And it originated from Don Murray. And I still do this now with our financial contributors. I write a letter called the Hummel Club, which my daughter finds uproariously funny. I'm like, kid, you're a charter member of the Hummel Club, whether you like it or not. Don Murray would run writing workshops to get, you know, they say take a chance and kind of do a back your way into a story. Or sometimes they went a little overboard. Somebody would be writing about a murder and you wouldn't discover they were like dead until the ninth paragraph.
Gotcha.
But so what we would do is they would nominate a bunch of stories from the week, and the reporters were whoever won was the committee. And so they'd have five stories, and they'd say, okay, I like Hummel's story, I like Bartholomew's story, I like Mark Patinkin's story. And they gave you a $25 gift certificate. But when the Journal had money, went to redeem it, you had to write How I Wrote the Story. Mm. And so it was, this is what you didn't see in the story. The Attorney General busted my balls trying to get, public records. I had a source who was a little skittish, and this is how I brought him around. I was thinking about leading with this, but Joel Rawson sat with me, and we decided to go this way. And it was really cool because all these reporters who I really admired, wow, he went through the same problem I did. Or, hey, he took a tack that maybe I can take next time. And it was fascinating. They actually turned it into two published books, How I Wrote the Story. And so I do the same thing now mindful that in the internet world, anybody could see anything. So I go a little light on the opinion, but I say, hey, Macaulay House, a lot of us know that about Macaulay House, but did you know about Macaulay Ministries? And this is how I went about reporting the story, or the East Providence thing. Somebody told me that this guy that I was eventually profiling, he's a councilman with 33 contacts with district and superior court. And by the way, he spent time in the ACI and the Wyatt, and the guy running against him is correctional guard. I'm like, what? You know, that got my attention.
Yeah.
So that's been kind of cool. So you asked who I admired. I've been very fortunate to have editors all along the way. And I pretty much do what I'm doing now. I mean, without a safety net, I'm back with the Journal. But for 9 years, I was really kind of doing it on my own without an editor because of the foundation that was laid from these other people who took the time with me. And I will say I'm proud of people say, oh, you ever lost a libel suit? You know, because I poke people in the eye all the time, figuratively.
Yep.
Never been sued. Knock on wood. Never had a lawsuit filed against me in 36 years, which I'm very proud of because we do our homework. We're mainly going after public officials. That's a big difference, public and private.
Sure.
Resources and from a legal standpoint. And, you know, I know what I can get me in trouble. But at the same time, it's a testimony. We do our homework. And there were a couple times where I thought people were going to do it just to kind of, you know, slap the little gnat away.
Right.
But I will say, Arlene Violet is the chairman of my board, and having her on your side, there were a couple times she said, not only do I not see any grounds for a lawsuit, I see plenty of grounds for Mr. Hummel to file a slap suit against you. In that Arlene voice, right?
Absolutely.
And then they would flee. So it's been good. I've been very fortunate I got to tell you, there's not many people who started out in 1982 wanting to change the world who still get a chance to do it in their own little corner of the world. A lot of people have kind of gone on to other things, and it was a struggle early on with the nonprofit, but we've kind of reached our stride, and we're in a good place now.
Well, your commitment to the truth is something that's a huge inspiration to me personally, and everything that we do here. You know, it's something that you're one of the people I hold up as the real deal. You know,
can you tell my daughter that? She doesn't think I have a job. Yeah. When she was in seventh grade and we launched, I was working out of my house before we got an office, and I'd be in my pajamas on edit day, which was Tuesday. I'd be in my pajamas. She'd come home from school. Do you have a job? I'd be like, there's a lot of hard work going on in these pajamas. So thanks. I'm honored to be on the show.
Hey, if you like the work we're doing here on the Bartholomew Town Podcast, why not subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite listening platform? That's all for today's episode. Thanks for joining us in Bartholomew Town. We'll talk soon.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.